back to another episode of the Folkcraft Revival Podcast. I had a really fun time chatting with this week's guest. I'm talking with David Constantine, who is a bone worker specializing in early medieval European artifacts. He does a lot of replicas and reproductions of archaeological finds, which I find completely fascinating. I think I've realized that some of my favorite episodes are ones that we talk a lot about the history and the archaeology of things. I find that absolutely fascinating. And it's a little bit of a different perspective. Me personally, I've never really tried to do a really close replica of a specific archaeological find. I've always been more interested in learning the techniques and adapting them to create what I wanted to make. And it's just a different perspective where you try and closely, as close as you can, replicate an original piece. I think there's a lot of value there and a lot of interest there. And I think it makes you, you know, think a little more carefully about how things would have been made and how they had been made, the tools available, and makes you, I guess, think through the process of how it a particular piece needs to be made a little more thoroughly than when you approach it like I do. And it's more a functional grasp of the material and how to work it, if that makes sense. But anyways, I thought this episode was really enjoyable. Kind of reminded me of the one I did with Mike Frank. I think it was episode 22. That one was also very fascinating to me. We talked a lot about the history, and that was just probably one of my favorite episodes. I had a lot of fun with that one. So yeah. Anyways, I came across David when I was doing a little bit of research online about horn working. Because I found it a little bit interesting as I've been looking around. I have a couple of horns sitting in a box. I had a friend who was a butcher a few years ago, and I was asking him about horns, and so he just sawed off a couple and brought them to me. And so I decided it was time to, you know, think about what I could make with them other than horn tips for a bow. And I know that things in the past, there was quite a lot that was historically made with horn, but I can't really find much in the way of good instructional material anywhere. And I came across David's, he has a little booklet that he wrote on working with, it's actually titled Working with Bone, Antler, and Horn. And that was probably the best resource that I found on the web for instructions on how things were made. And in there, he talks a lot about the period workmanship and the archaeological finds, things like that. So it was a really fascinating little booklet, and I'll be sure I link that up in the show notes for you. It definitely sparked an interest in me. And so I reached out to David to ask if he would be willing to come on the podcast. He said yes. And we spent a little while chatting beforehand about some of the history in his area. And he seems to be very much the history inclined individual. We had a lot of fun chatting. So, but I think one of the reasons this was a good episode to have is because we're talking about bone working. And I don't really know of any craftsmen who work in bone anymore. If we talk about woodworking or blacksmithing or leather crafting or weaving or something like that, I can find people that do it. I don't really know of anyone who works with bone as a raw material. It's a raw material that we kind of just tend to overlook these days, which is kind of interesting. And it seems kind of a shame that an entire material is being completely ignored and overlooked. So hopefully this sparks a little bit of interest in a few of you. I know it did in me, and I'm going to be kind of looking for some projects I can do with bone, just to experiment with, play with a little bit, learn it as a material and how it works and what I can do with it, what it's good for and what it's not. And yeah, like I said, hope it sparks that same interest in a couple of you. And as a brief aside, David did used to run a blog around bone working. I will link that in the show notes for the episode. Those will be over at folkcraftrevival.com/37. But he readily acknowledged that he doesn't really upkeep that anymore. But I'm going to link to it anyways. And then I'm also going to link to his booklet. And especially, I'm going to put a link to his bibliography section on his blog. Because he had a lot of really interesting and intriguing resources that I think other people might enjoy taking a look at and potentially reading. So I'll include links there, as well as a link to anything else we discuss in the episode, mainly the couple of books there at the end that we talk about as potential other learning resources for people. So with that, let's go ahead and jump into the episode. So I started out asking Dave what early medieval is and what he means by early medieval when he says he's an early medieval bone worker and reenactor.
Generally, the early medieval is what most people would call the Dark Ages, though it's a bit of a misnomer, hence now why it's generally referred to as early medieval instead. The Dark Ages is an older term signifying that after the light of the Roman Empire went away, Britain and parts of the continent were somewhat stifled in technology and artistry and all that kind of thing until the Normans came along and saved everybody.
Yeah.
That's not really true at all. So this is why it's generally now termed the early medieval instead.
Okay.
So it's any time from after the Roman period, so generally 400 to 450 to around about 1050 to 1100. That's taking it, that's expanding it either way a little bit. Essentially what it covers is what most people would think of when you think of Vikings and Saxons.
Okay.
In the UK. So ending roughly with the Norman conquest in 1066, Battle of Hastings, all that kind of stuff. So that's essentially what the early medieval is.
Just from how we've been chatting and whatnot, I can tell you're a history buff and you're into this sort of thing. But I would also say that's another part. I mean, we were talking earlier how history is so much more present for you guys over there in Europe. And I was just thinking, I was chatting with Helen Hart up in Scotland, and she was talking about some of the old, the old stone buildings and whatnot. And you guys still have signs of like the Roman occupancy and things like that. You still have structures, and it's just kind of crazy thinking about that sort of history still being around. But that's kind of the period just after that, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, where I am, I'm within an hour of Hadrian's Wall, so we've got, probably the earliest thing around here is there's a Mesolithic rock shelter, so Middle Stone Age, before they were farming, that's, 8,000-9,000 years old, something like 7,000 or 8,000 years old at least.
Wow.
That's 15 minutes drive from here. Medieval castles, we've got some of the best castles in the country, Norham Castle, Bamborough Castle, Alnwick Castle, things like that, all within half an hour drive of here, all the way up to, as we said before, World War II pillboxes and other defensive things like that. Specifically to do with the Dark Ages, the early medieval period, Northumberland now, was one of the four Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
Yep.
And it was the biggest and the most powerful. And the initial Viking raid on Lindisfarne, Holy Island, Holy Island's about 15 minutes drive from here. So right there, you've got the very first Viking raid on the country. And there's a lot of history in the local area.
That right there really brings the local history to life. And when you start looking at a history book, looking at what happened, reading about it, and you can then go visit that location, I mean, that does wonders for helping things like that stick in your mind and make it a little more relevant.
Yeah. Well, at the time that happened, just over the sea, only literally 2-3 miles away, is Bamborough Castle, which is this huge volcanic outcrop of rock that now has this very impressive medieval castle on it. But at the time, it was an Anglo-Saxon stronghold,
okay,
basically of the kings. You will have probably, come across the Last Kingdom TV series about Uhtred.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's Uhtred of Bebbanburg. That's Uhtred of Bamborough. Yes, it's fictional, but that's where he's meant to be from, because there really was an Uhtred later on than it's the TV series is set, but there was an Uhtred from Bamburgh, and that's where that's meant to be. And so that was this big Anglo-Saxon royal palace at the time. So in doing the bone work, and I've actually worked with the archaeologists there and handled the artifacts, made direct copies of them, done the identification of some of them and things like that, including actually writing up the archaeological reports for some of them as well. So you can get very, very hands-on with the actual pieces themselves.
How did you get involved with the archaeology side of things?
Well, I've been involved with archaeology my entire life. Both my parents were archaeologists long before I was born and were digging some of the major sites such as York and Lincoln and places like that where you had big Viking and Saxon settlements anyway. So I've just brought up with that and all the attendant things to do with it, going to museums and archaeological sites and getting to see behind the scenes because they were friends with all the people that were still digging them. And so getting to go behind the scenes in, like, say, museums and things like that. And then when they started digging at Bamburgh again, after a bit of a hiatus, I basically went along and said, look, I've got some knowledge of bones. I dabble in bone identification and things like that, as well as the actual finds. You're looking for volunteers and stuff. Can I have a look at some of your bones? So on and off, I spent a few summers cataloging the finds that they'd had and identifying them and identifying how they were made and the materials and things like that.
Hey, that's fun. I noticed just from the booklet that I had originally contacted you about, the one about working bones and antlers, it's a little more thoroughly written than most just average craftsmen or something like that would be putting out. You seem to have a little bit more of a scientific procedure approach to the booklet as well.
Well, that was because the society that I was working with at the time, that I was a member of at the time, the Reenactment Society, bone and antler working isn't terribly common in the modern day at all. And so, it, as I said to you before, people don't have even a background working knowledge of it necessarily. Somebody picks up woodworking and they decide to do it, they kind of know what to do. Blacksmithing, you've kind of got an idea of what a blacksmith does. You've got, you know, you stick some metal in, it gets hot, you put it on something, you hammer it while it's hot, and you've got an idea.
And more importantly, it's easier to find resources teaching you. I mean,
yes,
you can go find a book, or you can go find an instructional video, or more than likely, you can probably ask around and find a blacksmith that'd be willing to show you a thing or two.
Exactly. But one of the most common antler artifacts is a comb. You just pick a normal layperson and go, right, how do you make one of these? They wouldn't know where to start. And so, obviously, all reenactors, to begin with, come from a position of not knowing things.
Yep.
So, as one of the more experienced bone workers in the society and one who was testing other people and seeing how good they were at what they were doing, I just thought, there's no point in keeping knowledge to yourself.
Yeah.
So I would just write it all down. I would make a book that would teach somebody how to do it. So it would go through the tools and the techniques and the methods, the example artifacts, all that kind of stuff. And to keep myself right, and so it can be updated as necessary, it needed to be referenced. It needed to be that if somebody went, well, hang on, you said that this was made this way and this was made this way, how do you know? Well, there's the two reports. That one was found here. That one was found there. There you go. There's all the information.
Yeah.
So that's why it's as in-depth and thorough as it is. That's a significantly cut down version of what I was starting to write, because that's the core part of an actual book.
Yeah.
Rather than just a booklet. So that's basically the freebie here. Anybody can have this one, while the rest of the book is actually getting written in depth.
Is that something you're still working on at the moment?
On and off, yes. As I said, I've been out of the actual crafting side of it for a couple of years because of moving from a house in the countryside with a shed that actually, I was just saying about Lindisfarne, that's how close that one was to the coast. My shed window when I was working overlooked the monastery on Lindisfarne.
Okay, cool.
It was that close to the island. But with Len moving into a flat, no space.
Yeah.
So it's kind of been on the back burner until I got somewhere like I have now where I can actually set up a workshop. And then once that's all finished, I'm going to get back into it. Because as you can see, it hasn't been updated for some time. And things will have changed. There's always things I can go back and edit and tweak and add.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do want to get it updated and make sure, because I still get people like yourself messaging me asking for information, asking for leads on references and things like that. So there's been a lot more published in the last 8 years, so it would be nice to bring it a bit more up to date again.
I do need to peruse the like the bibliography and whatnot you reference and throughout your website and in that little booklet as well, because yeah, there's a lot of interesting sounding resources. I don't know necessarily which ones would be the best ones to look at, but there's a lot that look interesting and that I could learn a lot from. But yeah, I came across your booklet because there's really not a whole lot in the way of materials out there talking about bone working or horn working, which is what I was actually originally starting to look for. So I got on and I was typing things up and trying to find stuff, and I really wasn't coming across much. And it was very, very helpful when I found your little booklet, because yeah, there's actually a little bit of practical how-to information mixed with the history and what historically would have been done and was done. So I found it very, very helpful.
That was the point I was coming from, because while I've got a background in the bones and such, the bone working side of things, the practical application, I was basically learning myself.
Yeah.
And when I first started looking back for resources, I originally started doing this back in 2002. And there was a couple of things from the 90s on the internet written by SCA members and similar, and a couple of things referencing stuff from the 80s about making a comb that somebody had done as an actual scientific procedure to see how they were made. But that was it. And there was big gaps in the information. So I thought, well, no, it really needs to be something that pulls it all together, even if it's just relatively skimming the surface like this and pulling it together and just saying to people, there's a starting point. Which is why on the actual bibliography side of things on the website, if I've come across anything that's available as a free PDF, I've tried to make sure I link the PDF.
Yeah.
I know some of those links, because of the repositories and things, they get deleted, but...
But you do what you can.
There's no point in trying to hide where any information comes from. If I got this information from this article and this article is available for free online, well, there you go.
Yeah.
So go and read it.
What you were trying to do with the booklet is essentially what I would like to do with this podcast episode, is kind of skim the surface and give people a starting point to even consider working with bone. Because as I mentioned to you, you know, I know woodworkers, I know blacksmiths, I know people who make baskets, people who tan leather. I don't know anyone who really works with bone. You know, I come from kind of a primitive skills background. So the closest I have is, yeah, in my mind, when I think bone working, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to make a fleshing tool to clean up a hide when I'm tanning it, or I'm going to make like a bone knife if I don't have any flint or something like that nearby. But I want to kind of, A, explore the space a little bit myself and learn a little bit about where I would start and what the procedure should be if I was interested in learning a little more about bone working. And then also, you know, kind of expand my horizons. What should I consider as like possible options to be made from bone?
The general bone that's used for most things is, if you imagine a hoofed animal, basically we have two long bones, or two groups of long bones, in each one of our limbs. So for example, you've got your lower arm with the ulnar and radius. You've then got your upper arm with the humerus.
Yep.
In a hoofed animal, they have three. So if you imagine, if you put your hand on the table on your fingertips, your finger bones and then the nails expand up over them, that becomes the hoof.
Yeah.
The bones in the back of your hand or the top of your foot have essentially over time then fused together and formed another long bone. That basically has no meat on it. It's essentially just skin. So it's actually a long bone between the wrist or the ankle and then the hoof or hooves, if it's a... if it's got two hooves. So that bone is waste. So if you dig up early medieval pits and things like that, or Roman pits or slightly later, you've just got dozens and dozens of the ends of these bones, because they were waste from butchery. Nowadays, they're still exactly the same. They've still hardly got any meat on them. So they're still waste from butchery. So they're the ones that get drilled out, boiled and bleached and turned into bones you buy for your dog in the pet shop.
Yeah. 2 weeks ago, I shot myself a deer, and I told you I needed a project for the lower legs in one of our email. That's exactly the same thing. I had cut off the lower legs, and I had cut the sinews out of them to sinew back a bow, but at this point, I don't really have anything to do with the bones. So, yeah, it's a waste product.
I mean, usually the bigger hoofed animals, primarily cows, because they're the ones that you get the meat off. You know, people tend not to herd horses for meat and things.
Yeah.
They tend to be the most useful because if you take that bone, generically called metapodial, you've got the metatarsus and the metacarpal. So the metapodials is what they're called as a whole, or in more colloquially, cannon bones.
That's the term I'm familiar with.
Yeah, if you look at those in cross-section, they look like a D. So you've got a flat back, roughly, and then it curves. So when you've got something like a cow where the wall thickness might be 5-6 millimeters easily because it's so load-bearing, you can cut pins and needles and belt buckles and all kinds of things from that bone.
Yeah.
When you move on to different animals, so for example, deer, sheep, goats, where they're a bit more slender, you've got less options with that bone. So something like the same bone, the cannon bone from a deer or a sheep, you might cut the ends off, plug them and make it into a needle case because it's a natural tube. Moving slightly higher up, something like a humerus, where it basically narrows at one end, but then at the other end where it would connect to the shoulder blade, it expands. Or a tibia, which is the lower leg bone that goes and does the same thing, joining onto the femur. Those might get made into whistles because you've got one end that expands. You can fill it in with wax and such to create that narrow channel for blowing, and then make yourself a bone whistle, just the same as with long bones from birds. So in your case in particular, I know that the turkeys, the wild turkeys, I know a lot of primitive skills experts will make whistles out of their leg bones, but generally speaking, the long bones in the wings, which are essentially the same as our long bones in our arms, so things such as the ulna and so on, that can be made into whistles. In fact, the earliest example of a bone whistle, if I remember rightly, is a Neanderthal whistle made from a vulture's wing bone. And that's 40-odd thousand years old, maybe 44, 45,000 years old.
Yeah.
And that's actually a bird bone whistle. So unlike some of the earlier things where it's bones with a few marks on it and people are like, well, was that somebody trying to carve something or is it butchery marks? A whistle is a whistle. You cannot mistake the fact somebody took this long bone and they put 4 or 5 holes in it and they've trimmed one end and cut both ends off. Yeah, that's definitely manufactured. There's no mistaking that whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so it's been going on for tens of thousands of years. And
just kind of to put things in perspective on this timeline too. So you were just talking about a bone whistle 40,000 years old that we know.
Yeah.
How far back does most of the archaeological evidence for bone working and what time period do most of the artifacts come from? Do you have any idea?
The oldest one that I'm aware of is meant to be about 50, 51,000 years old. And that's one of these bones where it looks like it's got too much damage on it to have just been butchery marks.
Yeah.
But you can't quite make out what it's meant to be. It looks like it's been trimmed off so it will sit flat on a base, and then it's had some incisions made on it. So it's possibly meant to be a representative of a statue or something like that.
Okay.
That's about the point where beyond that, it's very difficult to tell because you've got crude tools.
Yeah.
But it's the same as when you get so far back with flint. You can get to a point and you can see that they've used a sharp edge of flint, but there's no retouching or anything like that. It's basically, at best, they've smashed two rocks together and picked up the sharp bits. But then later on, you can see where they've retouched the edges, and it's actually a real tool.
I was saying, not to naysay that either, because, I mean, you smash a rock together, you get sharp bits, and it's perfectly useful for skinning an animal or shaving a little bit of wood down to shape whatever you're working on or something like that. So not to naysay that, but it's just not as evident as when, or it's not as obviously a tool as when it's been further worked and retouched.
That's what I mean, yeah. And then once it gets to the point of them retouching them and things, you can clearly and definitely say, no, they are actually making tools here. They're not just using a stick to poke things. And it's kind of the same with the bones. You can see fragments of bone earlier on that have got wear marks on the point. But was that simply just a smashed piece of bone? It happened to be a sharp splinter, so they used it. Versus something where, no, this is a harpoon where they've clearly cut the teeth into it, or this is a whistle where they've clearly made holes. So I would say you're probably looking for definite evidence around about 50,000 years.
Okay.
There might be something on that as well. That's not really my sort of area of expertise at all.
No.
I just periodically come across things like that I find interesting, partly because of doing research on making instruments and the bone whistles, which is why I know of that particular example. And there's another one from around about the same time made from a cave bear bone. The other interesting thing with that is, as I said before, these are actually evidence of artifacts from Neanderthal sites, not modern human. We were doing it as well, but it's also interesting that the people still have this idea of sort of knuckle-dragging Neanderthals. But there's evidence there that they're making music. And if this little figurine, if that's what it is, was some sort of representation of a god or anything similar, well, that's also Neanderthal. And so the idea of the cultural ideas of making music and art and religion and worship and things look like they were very strong both with us and them. And then the bone working rapidly develops later on. And by the time you get to, say, the Mesolithic, so the Middle Stone Age, so Neanderthal and early humans, you're dealing with the Paleolithic, the Old Stone Age. So that's when you really have this idea of cavemen. You then end up with the Mesolithic, which is the Middle Stone Age. And, sorry, I don't know if you know this, where you mentioned about flint tools and things as well. That's characterized by what we term as microliths, so small flints.
Yeah.
And they're starting to build more in the way of semi-permanent structures and such. But that's when you start finding things like composite harpoons. So somebody's taken a long spear point of antler, put a groove in it, and then glued small chips of flint into it. Or they've come up with proper barbed harpoons entirely carved out of antler. And that in itself requires its own special techniques. It's something that's termed groove and splinter, because you're still only trying to work antler with stone tools. And antler is an incredibly hard material. So they end up with scoring through the harder outer cortical bone of the antler with the flint to be able to prise it off the more woody looking spongy texture inside and then working it from there. So you have this rapid development in skills and, I suppose, finesse as well. The actual artifacts themselves become a lot more delicate.
Yeah.
And then that just carries on through the Neolithic, the Bronze Age, and so on, and then into the Iron Age, which is just the pre-Roman period over here. It starts to, you see a lot of bone items used for everything. You see it as toggles on horse harness, you see handles of tools and weapons, and again, still continue with things like needles and harpoons and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But also starting to make things like combs and other similar things. Then into the Roman period, you end up with what's termed the composite comb, which is one of these ones where it's multi-piece riveted together. You do get those earlier on as well, but not to quite the same extent. And then the early medieval period is where it just, that's probably the high point of bone working across the spectrum.
That's what I was going to ask you, is when it really reached its pinnacle. Do you think that was during the early medieval?
Yes, because you've got every aspect you can think of. So you've got the incredible religious ivory carvings and things like that, figurines carved out of walrus ivory. And I say religious scenes carved in elephant ivory, in some cases even mammoth ivory that's been recovered and traded from the north.
Yeah.
You've got antler combs being made by basically everybody on the continent, and they're just absolutely amazing. There's possibly even individual regional and sort of tribal variations in them. Fashions change very quickly. You can identify patterns that you get in the continent, and even though they're trading with England, you don't get that pattern in England, but we do trade some patterns back the other way and things like that. And then you still get across the board belt buckles, knife handles, crude tools where somebody simply needs something, so they make it. I've seen, I'm not sure what the correct term is because it's so long since I used it, but when you're stripping the membrane and the last vestiges of meat from the inside of a skin to tan it.
Yep.
And if you make, you can make those tools out of bone because, yes, they've got a sharp edge, but they don't have a, they're not such a sharp edge that they'll catch and tear.
So that's more of what I'm familiar with because I do a little bit of tanning. So when I mentioned bone implants, yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
So you see things like that. And again, still things like harpoons, pins, brooches, pendants, all kinds of things across the board out of bone and antler. Primarily, the simpler or cruder items tend to be bone. The more specifically made items, such as the combs, where they're truly manufactured, tend to be antler, because while they're the same material at its chemically at its heart, bone is generally designed to be incredibly good in one direction. So, for example, the metapodia I was mentioning before, the cannon bones, they're designed to take the weight of a half or three quarter ton animal running around.
That makes sense.
But all that force is directed down the length of the bone.
Yeah.
As evidenced when horse racing and something goes wrong and they land funny, they are not designed for torsion and they just go ping and snap.
Yep. Yep.
Antler, on the other hand, is designed to be hit at speed with a great deal of force from every direction.
Which is interesting because, yes, the animals would be sparring and whatnot, but at the same time, you would think that since bone is used daily, I mean, things are always running around, you would think that it would, or at least I would think that structurally it would be a little tougher than antler, but you're saying not so, huh? Because antler's used to being hit from any direction?
Well, that's what it's, that's its sole purpose. It's its only purpose. Whereas the bone is incredibly strong, but only in the plane it's designed to be used in. So if you get one of these compression tests and you put a cut off cannon bone in them so it can sit in it neatly, it will take quite a lot of force before it shatters.
Yeah.
However, if you put it the other way around so it's got that D shape and you apply the force there, well, that's not where it's meant to be hit. That's not where it's meant to have force exerted. So it shatters under a lot less pressure.
That makes sense.
And if you get either end and twist, well, yeah, it's definitely not designed for that. So it is incredibly strong. And in certain situations, especially wet bone, where because bones are an organic component and an inorganic component, and once it's been dried out and worked, it tends to lose the organic, which is what gives it any flexibility.
Okay.
If you get wet bone, fresh bone, yes, it's stronger, but it's still only designed, if you're a cow running along, the force is designed to go up and down that bone. Whereas with the deer, it's designed to be dried out, because usually when they're rutting and such, all the velvets come off anyway. So it's designed to be a finished item. It's not meant to continually grow, whereas bone is living. As long as the animal is living, the bone is living.
Yeah.
Whereas antler isn't. Antler gets its blood supply cut off, it dies, and it's then just solid. So generally speaking, it's three times or thereabouts stronger than a given piece of bone of the same size, which means that things like combs, where the teeth are tiny, some of the early medieval combs, the teeth are less than a millimeter across. You can actually press them with your finger so they bend, and then they'll spring back, which when you're brushing your hair is what you want.
Yeah.
You get a comb made out of bone and you hit a tangle or you put too much pressure on the teeth, they'll snap. And you can see this in the manufacturing of them as well, where you can see repairs to the comb because individual teeth have snapped. So they've replaced the entire plate. They've knocked the rivets out and replaced the whole plate with a new one because the teeth are breaking. Happens with antler as well, but not as often.
So now I'm thinking about antler, and it seems like antler, it's even harder to find. I mean, with the cows, yeah, you got a decent size leg bone that you can work with. With antler, it doesn't seem like you ever get as big of material to work with, though.
No, that's where the other side of it comes in, because when you're working with bone, if you just need something, you just need a pin to do something or a bodkin or whatever.
Yeah.
Bone is there, it's cheap, it's plentiful. It's not an issue. You've got an almost unlimited supply of it. Antler, on the other hand, you'll know yourself from doing primitive skills and things, you can't just go and get it.
Yeah.
You need to know where to get it. You can only get it when it's fallen off, usually, unless you're actually going to go and hunt. But that's an entirely different matter in itself. Basically, antler that is fully grown and has been shed is better. And they knew this. If you excavate any sites from the early medieval period where they were working antler en masse, when you find a waste pit, it will be full of the burrs from the bottom because they don't need them.
Yep.
There's usually a 2-to-1 split between shed versus cut because the shed ones are better and they knew the shed antler was stronger. So, like, hunted antler was like B grade because how close was it to being finished? How strong was it relative to the shed stuff? The shed antler, you know, it had done its job, it was at its strongest, and then it had dropped off.
So as long as you can find stuff that's relatively new, because, yeah, if it's been sitting around out in the woods for a while, it starts to degrade. Yeah.
So this year's is the best, which means people need to be going out and collecting it. So some people might just find it, but people aren't just generally walking through the woods for the fun of it. So that in itself becomes its own skill. Going and finding the antler, and this is where you get into all these different trade networks and things. So it's possible that you might have a roving comb maker, for example, who goes around the villages, towns, whatever. In the course of the year, they gather the antler. He takes a payment. And as part of the payment, he then makes them some combs from the antler they've gathered. He then takes the rest of it to make stock. Then he moves on to the next village. Or he's got a central location in one of the big towns, and people bring the antler in to him in exchange for money, combs themselves, or artifacts that they'll then go and trade, sell, and so on.
Yeah.
Because you can't have one person spending all their time making stock and going out. Especially if you're in a town where you're not near a lot of deer, because it also has to be particular types. Over here, native to this country, in that period, you've only got two deer. You've got the roe deer, which possibly the closest American equivalent would be maybe whitetail. So something with basically small and pokey antlers. They're about 8 or 9 inches long. They're about 1/2 inch in diameter, maybe 3/4. They're not very good. They're all knobbly and not particularly great.
So I'm looking at pictures of a roe deer now. Yeah, they don't look like they grow very much in the way of antlers.
Nope, they're quite small. They're not generally much bigger than sheep or goats or something like that. The other deer that we have are red deer, which are your classic Scottish deer with the big 18, 20, 22 point antler sets. Those, on the other hand, they have very nice antlers for working, because the antler is thick enough that you can actually get plates from them. That's the ones that on my blog, they're what I work with. So generally speaking, the photographs of antler and things like that, it's those.
Okay. A red deer looks like the European equivalent of basically an elk in the US.
Not quite.
Not really?
Elk would be, or what we would term elk, would be what you would term moose. We don't have elk in the UK, but they are in Northern Europe, and they would have been more prevalent during the Viking period. And same with reindeer. We did used to have reindeer in the UK, but then they died out, but they're still in Scandinavia. Yeah. So you end up with elk and reindeer antler combs as well, and that's evidence of trade into this country. Because we couldn't hunt reindeer in this country, so if you find artifacts made of reindeer antler, either the artifact is traded or the material is traded.
Yeah.
So you don't get big populations of red deer just everywhere. They are in certain areas. So if somebody's in a town or a city that's not near a population, well, they have to have the material traded in order to be able to work it. And so there's lots of things tying in trade routes and all sorts of other professions and such. Generally speaking, bone working isn't a profession by itself. You wouldn't have a little Anglo-Saxon village with a bone worker
and you go to him and he will sell you a bone pin or something like that. Really, the only one that's probably a real profession would be comb making, because it's a specialist skill set and it's a specialist tool set.
Yeah.
For example, it's just about the only thing that uses a saw. If you take the three big crafts of the period, metalworking, woodworking, boneworking, in order to cut metal with a saw, you need special hardened teeth.
Yeah.
And special material. When you've got a forge and a chisel, just heat up the metal and cut it.
Yep.
That's the easiest way of doing it. Woodworking, a lot of the woodworking is green woodworking. And if you cut something with a saw, it cuts across the grain, or it doesn't leave it strong. Because obviously if you split the timber and you follow the grain, it's much more flexible.
Yep.
And when you're looking at the woodworking of the time, the big woodworking, you're looking at boats, bridges, buildings, things like that. Perfect example, it's not infallible, but it's a handy example, is the Bay of Tapestry shows the Normans building the invasion fleet to invade England. And it goes through from them felling the trees to launching the boats. And you can see people working with axes and chisels and adzes. They're splitting the timber and things like that.
Yeah.
The one tool that isn't on display is a saw. They're not using hand saws for timber.
That's interesting.
Why would you cross cut your timber or rip it with a saw when you're building a boat, when what you want is to follow the grain so it's flexible? You wouldn't just rip it. So they are used on a small scale for woodworking, but not massively so. However, when you come to cutting antler, if you're trying to cut those teeny tiny little teeth on a comb, what else can you do it with other than a thin saw?
That's definitely the easiest. Yeah.
Yeah. So the comb worker would have a saw. You need a saw for sectioning the antler to begin with.
Yeah.
You then need a drill for drilling the holes in it. You then need a hammer and a small anvil in order to be able to rivet it together. You then might need a chisel for splitting the antler further. So you end up with it, rasps and files for smoothing it. And then finer grades of things as well. So possibly leather with sand, or wet leather with sand or ash, something similar to that. The plant horsetail has been used as well, shave grass. I'm not sure if you've got a similar thing in America.
Scouring rush or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. So you've got this immense toolkit of all these different things that you would be using just for making a comb. That's not the kind of toolkit just a general person has lying around.
But it seems interesting to me that you say that there was, you know, there was kind of just the specialty, the comb maker, and they didn't work with other bone or antler artifacts. Mostly it was primarily one industry. Work with them,
but not necessarily to the extent of being somebody who... You wouldn't walk down a street in Jorvik and necessarily have a shop where there was a counter full of bone needles, bone pins, bone combs, and things like that. That's more what I was getting at. The chances are the simple bone artifacts were probably made as necessary.
More homemade.
Yeah, the sort of thing where you can just pick up a bone, smash it to get a splinter, and then you can use a knife to whittle it into a needle.
Okay.
And then the point is, like, you stick a hole in it. There you go. I've done that myself when I'm at shows without too much difficulty at all. And you can churn out needles and things that do the job without too much trouble. You don't need anything other than a decent knife with a point on it. Whereas because of the way that a comb's made, it has to be, it also involves proper knowledge.
So a little more finesse, so, and a little bit more in the way of tools.
Yes. So bone and antler have a grain, just the same as wood, and it runs along its length. So when you're putting a comb together, you've got the side plates, and then riveted between them are the tooth plates. So I'm not sure if you've seen it on the blog, but if you imagine having a series of plates, maybe an inch by inch and a half, you put those next to each other, and the grain is running up and down those ones. So that's where the teeth will be. So the grain runs up and down the teeth, because if it went across the teeth, they would just snap.
They'd break, yeah.
However, on the side plates, you need the grain running across them, so it's running at right angles to that on the teeth. Because again, if the side plates just had the grain running up and down, they would just snap in half and you end up with a comb in two pieces.
Yeah.
So you need to know how to work the materials. You need to know where on the antler to get the correct material, then how to finish it. And in order to stop it moving, the backs and the fronts of the tooth plates and the backs of the side plates need to be as smooth and flat as possible. So then you're getting into using something like some form of a vise or a grip to then be able to use your rasps and files on it and being able to fit them, clamp them together to then drill through. Because when you drill it, you drill through the side plates, but on the joint of the tooth plates, so that when you compress the rivet, it pushes left and right. Because on the other side of a tooth plate is another rivet pushing in the opposite direction. And that's what grips it. That's what holds it in place. So there's a lot of nuances to it.
Yeah.
Lots of little bits and pieces. Do they need to know how to draw out their own wire and clip it in order to make the rivets? Or do you just go along to the blacksmith and you get him to make you 500 of your standard size rivets? And then you basically make him fit the comb or things like that. So it involves different professions or a very big skill set for one person involving all kinds of different tools.
I don't think about combs as really being that complex, but the way we're talking about it, yeah, it starts sounding like a lot more work went into them than I would have necessarily thought.
A composite comb is a lot of work, and it's a skill that has been lost. I think the last factory mass production was in the 1700s, maybe 1800s.
It did reach the point then that it became like an industry where they were being made in the factory?
Yes. Post-medieval, yes, you had, I say, you still had tortoiseshell combs, horn combs, all the kinds of things that were used basically before somebody invented plastic. And that's what signaled the death for this kind of material.
Yeah.
There's unfortunately not an overarching word that covers it, because you've got bone, which is one material. You've then got teeth and ivory, which is another material, and then horn, which is another one. So I think the term that correctly covers them is something like osteodentocoracic material or something like that, basically, bone, teeth and horn. But all of them were used for similar things. They were used in place of plastic. And once plastic becomes available and mass-produced and you don't need to work it, you simply mold it.
Fill a mold.
There you go.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, suddenly that's the death knell for those materials, especially as well when increased industrialization, you're ending up moving away from the agricultural model as well that supplies those materials in such bulk in local areas. Until you get to now, where I've actually had, when I've been on display, I've had some members of the public who basically refuse to believe I actually have bone on display and insist it must be plastic or it must be resin. They just cannot get their head around the fact that somebody would actually willingly handle bone.
That's an interesting perspective they have, but it also speaks, I think, to the fact that you don't go to the butcher anymore. You go to the supermarket and you buy meat in a package. It's not going to the butcher and requesting specific cuts or anything like that, where you still have the animal being cut up and you still have things like bones and stuff like that readily available. You don't necessarily see that in the supermarket anymore these days.
Yeah, there's a big disconnect, and there is with a lot of things and a lot of skills being lost.
Yeah.
But it's much more noticeable when working with bone. Antler and similar things, just because maybe you're saying about your interest mostly being in horn and things, or coming at it from that point of view. Most people will just consider horn to be a drinking horn, that's it, which ultimately that's actually had minimal work done to it. It's had the top trimmed off, it's been cleaned out.
Yeah,
that's basically it. Whereas horn can be used for so much more. It's a terrible, terrible material for surviving in the ground. Compared to bone and antler, horn survival rate is absolutely horrendous. So it's incredibly rare to find horn artifacts outside of specific environments. But we do have some, and now with modern technology, you can also look for the remains of horn in corrosion on materials. So one thing we're finding out is actually horn was used a lot for knife handles as well. If you take a horn, if you take a white or a cream horn and you split it, because the way that horn's created is it's basically the same material as hair. It's layered down with a natural glue. And you can see this. If you take a coarse piece of sandpaper and you rub horn, it will get fuzzy.
Yep.
Won't create dust. It'll become fuzzy because it's separating. So if you take this layered horn, because again, unlike antler, horn's constantly growing. Horn is a living thing, part of the animal. Antler grows, dies, falls off, is grown again. Horn isn't. You dehorn an animal, it's dehorned forever. It will never grow back.
Yep.
So it puts on layers when it's growing. You can delaminate these layers by soaking it. And if you do that with a white or a cream horn, and you get the layers thin enough, oil them, they actually go translucent. And then you can use them like panes of glass. You can put them in a little thing around a candle and have a lanthorn, yeah, which over time just becomes lantern. So people use them for things like that. Later on, there's entire windows, just the same as you see now, panes of glass, where you've got an entire window made out of small bits of glass that are maybe 6 by 4 inches or something like that. You see the same thing in the medieval and post-medieval, where it's pieces of horn instead.
Wow.
They will use them for combs as well. Basically, horn becomes malleable when you heat it up. So if you cut a horn up, you can unfold it into an almost rectangular sheet. And then again, you can delaminate it and such to create window panes or similar. But you can also then use that as a flat material, cut that into a comb by itself. And you can see the development of the horn working techniques, because you can't only use heat, you also have to apply pressure. So later on, that's not a problem. You have industrial presses, you have hydraulic presses, the screw threads where you can simply apply it the same as you would an apple press or a cider press. That's not an issue. Early on, however, you're simply looking at pure weight. So you put it between a couple of sheets or something and pile a bunch of rocks on it, which is never going to have the same amount of pressure as even something with a screw thread, let alone a hydraulic press or anything similar.
Yeah.
So you can actually see the development of horn working as well. So in the late Anglo-Saxon period, so 10th century, early 11th century, you get these very crude horn combs made, where what they've actually done to try and, because if you don't flatten it properly, it will curl back into its original shape.
Okay, that makes sense.
So what they attempt to do is they make a single sheet of horn, cut a comb into it, but then they actually split cow ribs and put them on either side and rivet them together as a side plate to attempt to stop the horn curling back, because they're mass produced compared to the antler combs that were properly a skilled trade.
Yeah.
By the time you got to larger populations in urban areas, you can't keep up with supply. You can't keep up with demand. So they're mass producing these horn combs instead and having to just come up with a way of making them work. So they flatten them out roughly, cut the combs in. The teeth as well, even, you can tell they're crudely made, because the teeth might vary in size quite dramatically.
Yeah.
Whereas in the antler combs, the teeth and the space in between them might be accurate to within a tenth of a millimeter.
Wow.
So they're clearly using a guide and skill. They're taking pride in their work. Whereas the early horn combs, they're just knocking out however many a day.
Shows a little bit of ignorance here, because I've never really worked with it, but does horn also have the same grain that runs the length of it? So if you're not making a horn quite comb, do you need to make sure all your tines are going up and down the horn?
Yes, but it's not as critical, or it's not as critical in the same way as it is with bone and antler.
Okay.
Because horn will bend and delaminate and such before it fractures.
Oh.
Whereas bone will just go ping and break.
Yeah.
So it is important, but not to the same extent.
Huh.
But then later on, you end up with things like the modern day items where you literally just get a sheet of horn, you get a press that's the size of a bowl or a mug, and you just go, and you, that's it.
Yeah. There
you go. Hydraulic press, 30 seconds or however long, let it cool, trim it. There you go. You've got a horn bowl. And that's sort of the culmination of 1,000 years or more of learning the techniques. But to begin with, it's very crude.
Is that still going on? Do you know of any craftsmen working with horn, or is that kind of gone now that plastics came around too?
There's a big place over in on the west coast of England, in Cumbria, where they turn out all kinds of things, bowls and spoons and forks and drinking horn still and cups and all kinds of things like that, because there's still a market for it.
On one hand, that sounds really interesting. On the other hand, you just told us that a horn becomes flexible or plastic with heat. So it seems like it could be a problem if you had a bowl of hot soup or something like that. And you're
No, we're talking about a lot of heat.
Okay, a lot hotter than that.
You've basically got two methods of working it. You've got direct heat and indirect heat. Direct heat is using a blowtorch, holding it over a fire, something like that.
Okay.
Where if you're not careful, you'll scorch the outside before the center is heated up.
Yeah.
Indirect heat is using an oil bath. Now, you can use hot water. You can put it in boiling water. But the agitation of the water can cause its own issues. And obviously, it will never get hotter than 100 degrees.
Yeah.
Whereas an oil bath, you can have an oil bath at 150, 200 degrees without the agitation of the bubbles, because it's not boiling. And so, yeah, hot soup and things,
that's not going to cause a problem at all.
Maybe if you've got a thin horn spoon that you're using to make your coffee and you pour boiling water from the kettle straight into it, that's a different matter. You're generally not going to have an issue with having a horn bowl with soup in it and things like that.
Fascinating.
But that sort of technique is a lot later. You do get evidence of horn spoons and things very, very briefly in the early medieval, but they're made in the same way as wooden spoons, in that they appear to be carved. So the tip of the horn, where it's nice and chunky, you might take a sliver out of the body of the horn for the handle, and then you carve the tip, where it's quite chunky, you carve that into the bowl.
Yeah.
But again, they're few and far between because its preservation is so awful. But then you've also got evidence, again, of musical instruments, various blowing horns, and things like that, either as in your classic idea of a hunting horn, or as the horn attachment for the end of a long tube, where instead of trying to burn wood or anything like that, they just used a horn. But also as an actual playable instrument as well. So just a horn that's had its tip cut off so you can blow through it, but then with finger holes also cut into it so you can change the notes.
Yeah.
So it might be terribly subtle, but you can use one instrument to get different tones, different notes, and so on.
I'm going to have to try making myself one. Do you mind if we kind of jump into the practical how-to side of things for a minute, and kind of, for someone that's interested in doing a little bit of horn or bone or antler working? So you mentioned right at the start of the episode that you would recommend just going to the pet shop to get a bone. Outside of sourcing, though, let's say someone does go and they get a nice roast with a bone in it or something like that. Is that still a good way of doing it?
Nope. The key word that you mentioned there is roast.
Okay.
That makes the bone brittle.
Okay.
Roast bone, sometimes you're lucky and you can get away with it. But generally, more correctly, it's baking, because generally speaking, these days, people tend not... If you put it in the oven, it's baked rather than roasted, which is a slightly different procedure.
Yeah.
That makes the bone itself brittle. And the other issue is you can end up with the heat liquefying the grease, and it goes into the bone as well and can be very difficult to get out. Some of the things that you have to do to properly degrease bone when it's got to that extent, I've heard of people soaking it in petrol, gasoline, in order to degrease it, because it's that difficult to remove. So if you can avoid it ever getting to that stage, that's the best thing.
On that note, though, let's say, because I just made a bunch of broth from the deer that I had shot a couple weeks ago, and a lot of the bones and whatnot went into a stock to make soup. At that point, does boiling harm the bone, or is that at the higher temperature you get when you're trying to make a roast?
It tends not to harm it as such necessarily. What I tend to say to people with that is it can be the same issue as with the baking or the roasting. in that the boiling can liquefy the grease, because obviously inside the bone, you've got bone marrow as well.
Yep.
So what I would tend to do is, if I'm going to heat it, would be cut the ends off the bone, poke out as much of the stuff from inside as you can, peel off from the outside what you can, and then as it's heating, you'll notice that the membrane on the bone will start to contract.
Yeah.
Peel that off as well. And if possible, try to avoid letting it actually boil. And just as it's heating up and essentially the meat is cooking, pull it off as it gets easier to remove.
Okay, so it sounds like at this point that it's probably just not even worth throwing it in the pot to begin with. I might as well, if I have a bone project in mind, just pull it out and not throw that one in the pot with everything else.
Yes, that's what I would say. I generally don't use cooking bones for anything. Now, it's not to say people don't and people haven't in the past.
Yeah.
If you've got a splinter of bone and it happens to have come off a roast and somebody needed a bone needle, well, yeah, they probably made a bone needle from it.
Yeah.
Maybe it didn't last very long. It maybe splintered a bit, but it also maybe did the job. But from a point of view of somebody who's looking to work with bone and get nice end results, generally speaking, I would avoid cooked bone unless it's been specifically treated in such a way for bone working.
Yeah.
Equally, though, you go and look on the internet and there are plenty of people saying that they pulled a bone out of their Christmas turkey or whatever and they made a whistle out of it. Brilliant. I'm not saying it won't work. It just isn't necessarily the best way to do it.
And a whistle also doesn't really undergo much in the way of stresses compared to some other things that you might be making, say a comb or something like that. So
yeah.
So green or raw bone is best. Does it matter if it's been dried at all, or is it best to work it when it's still fresh and moist?
I've tried both. I actually did a series of experiments on both, either green bone, so completely fresh. I'd literally just strip the meat off it, nothing else.
Yeah.
Versus completely modern processed pet shop bone. The other reason I generally advise people on doing that is because it's already been cleaned for essentially public consumption.
Yeah.
It's safe. You're not involving cutting up dead animals and needing to do things properly. If you buy it from a pet shop, it's safe. And also white. A lot of people don't like bone that isn't white. Whereas that will be. They generally, again, it's this disconnect. People generally, I found when I was selling artifacts or making commissions, people could be put off by bone that looked like bone, that was actually bone colored. People are funny at times. So what you tend to find is green bone will work more like a wood, in that you can shave it. You can trim it with a knife a lot easier and things like that, because it's still got that organic component in it.
Yeah.
However, the downside to that is when you're trying to finish it, you won't easily be able to sand it because it's still literally wet. So it will clog anything you're trying to sand it with.
That makes sense.
And that won't work very well.
Yeah.
It might go a little bit fuzzy on the surface. Dry bone, on the other hand, cuts very nicely with a saw. You can score it and split it and things. However, you can't shape it with a knife as easily. There's more scraping than actual cutting.
Okay.
It's also, if you're trying to split it, so for example, in order to try and avoid wastage, what I would do is I would groove it with a saw and then try and split it with a chisel to get blanks out for needles, because then I'm not using the saw as much, which again, in period, before you've got saws with offset teeth and things like that, you don't want a saw that's going to bind. You don't want to keep sharpening the blade. So you'd be using your saw as little as possible. And if you've got a chisel and you can split the blanks, well, you do it that way instead.
That makes sense.
But when it's dry, you have to be careful. There's more chance of it shattering and actually splitting.
Hmm.
If it's naturally dry as well, in that it's been left outside, you have to watch out for the bone itself having become bleached in the sun and actually getting its own hairline cracks in it, because that will just destroy the entire project.
All sorts of problems. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can often see the surface might be starting to flake and things. And if you give it a good brush off and it's solid underneath, great. Other than that, just be careful. There's plenty of those sorts of bones where I've started using them and then they've shattered and they've ended up just becoming needles because I couldn't make anything bigger out of them. Personally, I like it with still a bit of grease in it. because that way you still end up with a little bit of flexibility. You tend not to have it at the point where it's cracking. Plus, I also quite like the look of that kind of proper bone color. And when it's finished, it looks nice.
Yeah.
That's my sort of ideal working point.
So bring this back a little bit for folks to understand. You said you like it with a little bit of greasiness. What does that mean from the perspective of you were talking before, you know, from a just harvested animal versus buying a pet shop bone? Like, where in the continuum is that lie?
Generally, what I would term to be not industrially processed. So something you can do at home on your stove. So trim the ends off, poke the marrow out, strip off the meat and things. So it's basically got its natural level of grease in it.
Yeah.
Whereas this is what I was saying, if you don't trim the ends off and you don't poke the marrow out and you don't take the other fatty bits off, when you heat it up, that liquefies and you end
too
up
much
with
grease.
It's got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
So the marrow, when it liquefies, just goes into the bone. And you can't just boil it out. So it's that sort of process rather than the fully industrialized process like pet shop bones have.
So essentially, though, you've just cleaned it.
Yeah.
As you poked the marrow out, you boiled it, you cleaned all the stuff off of it.
Yeah.
That's the point you like working it.
Yeah, like I say, the sort of stuff you can do at home, it's not an industrial process.
Yeah. Do you end up doing... So you were mentioning a few minutes ago that it's easier to shave and shape the bone when it's a little greener and then polish it and whatnot a little more when it's dry. Do you end up working in stages where you shape a bunch of green bone and then let it sit for a while to dry out before you continue the process? Or do you tend to work things all the way through in one go?
It depends what is usually the rough working with green bone tends to be the cutting the ends off, prepping it, things like that. Maybe with some bigger ones, possibly splitting it afterwards and then just letting them dry out a bit naturally.
Okay.
It really all depends on what I'm making and how intricate it is. Something like a needle where you've essentially just got two roughly straight sides going to a point doesn't really matter too much.
Yeah.
But a pin that's got a more elaborate head, for example, I might take a very fine-toothed, narrow-bladed saw, like a keyhole saw or something similar, and an actual hand jigsaw, and use that to roughly shape it first, just take out the big areas. Because again, then as it changes and it shrinks and contracts as it dries out and such, there's less chance of it breaking because there isn't such a large area to shrink.
Yeah.
So I tend to do a little bit of roughing out like that when it's green, but then the detail and the final shaping once it's dry or drier.
Is this something you have to kind of monitor and regulate? I've done some spoon carving, things like that. You start with green wood. And then you try and slow the drying process a little bit so all the moisture doesn't leave at once and crack your wood. Is that something you have to do with bone as well?
Not something I've ever really had an issue with.
Okay.
Yeah, for certain pieces, maybe it would help. Just as say, it's something where you're doing it big, where you're doing something big, you've got a thick piece of bone. But there's also not a right lot you can really do to stop it. The only thing I would say is what I tend to do is having a little bit of dampness on it is quite useful. So, for example, when I've been at shows where I'm shaping needles with a knife,
yeah,
I keep the blanks in a pot of water just so the surface is always just a little bit damp. And that just makes it easier for scraping and shaping with a knife blade. Antler, not so much because antler is so much denser, but normal bones.
Coming back, I mean, you've mentioned just shaving with a knife. Is that kind of like your go-to tool, or do you have... I guess for someone that was interested in bone as a material and working with bone and doing a little bit more, what sort of tools are helpful and what are your kind of go-to when you're working on a project?
Mostly come down to depending on what you're trying to do, but you can do an awful lot of it. Once you've one way or another roughed out your bone, be it with a saw and some people use an axe on big things as well.
Yeah,
generally speaking, a knife, a good solid knife comes to a nice point. Got a non-flexible blade, nice straight edge. Yeah, I mean, you can pick up a bird bone or a deer bone or something like that. You can trim the ends off it. You can poke some holes in it, shape it and so on. Make a whistle with no tools other than a knife. Needles, pins, things like that. Again, you can do a lot of the simple things with nothing more than a knife. I mean, even some of the bigger, more intricate pins, you can still use a knife for it. It'll just take you a little bit longer to shape the head. Whereas if you can roughly block it out with a saw first and then do the detail with a knife, it's a bit quicker. But this is what I was meaning about not having necessarily a bone worker for the simple stuff, because it's the kind of thing that anybody could do. And especially when you look at artifacts from the early medieval period of all sorts, be them made out of wood or bone or whatnot, your general everyday artifacts, they're not impressive in terms of the level of skill.
Yeah.
It's some guy sat by the fire who wanted a knife handle, so he whittled a knife handle and he put some carvings in that nowadays people are looking at going, is that a dog or a deer? Because they had exactly the same skill levels as we did.
Yep.
Some people, you look at it and it's an incredible carved relief head of it's a carved relief head of a Viking warrior with his trimmed beard and a helmet and everything else. And then in the next house, there might be a wooden bucket with a few scratches on it that looks like it's meant to be a pattern. And either
one speaks to my level of artistry right there. Yep.
Yeah.
The stick figure right there. I'm meant
to be the latter. I'm good at making the artifacts, less good at the intricate detail of some of the carving.
Yeah. When you talk about, we've talked about needles as an example of a fairly simple project a couple times, kind of looking the other end, what are some of the more intricate and involved projects that you've worked on?
Oh, probably variations on combs mostly. There are some incredibly intricate things out there. I've not done replicas of them all, but the combs are probably it. There was a few where people were doing very, very specific recreations of graves. So their entire outfit for doing the reenactment was based on one specific set of grave finds, so that they were as close to accurate as they could be, because the sword was the one that was in the burial, the clothes were based on whatever was in the burial if they could, and so on.
Yeah.
And so things had to be as spot on as possible. So I've done a few combs like that where they've literally had to be, well, this is 172 millimeters long. It has 119 teeth at this size. The other side has 75 teeth at this size, and things like that. Wow. Right to the extent where, in order to make those ones accurately, I've actually had to make custom tools just for making those combs.
Yeah.
Because the decoration on them, I didn't have the right size blade or the right size. It's not a stamp. The most common decoration just about is something called ring and dot, where you have a ring and there's a dot in the middle. And that's made using a little tool that's got either two or three prongs that you basically rotate. And that's what cuts the dot and then the ring around it. So I've had instances where there's been double or triple ring and dots that are within a fraction of a millimeter of each other. So I've had to develop my own tools at that specific size in order to make the replicas and things like that. So that's probably the most intricate. And some of those combs have taken 3 or 4 days to make just because of having to cut the teeth. And things like that. Every single tooth has to be cut absolutely vertically. In this particular instance as well, the reason that these were particularly difficult and hard to finish is at that particular point in time that these ones were based on, there was a lot of bone combs rather than antler.
Yeah.
And as I said before, bone is weaker. So you have to take an awful lot more care to avoid breaking the teeth. And unfortunately, yes, on one of them, I was cutting the last row of teeth and one of them broke.
Oh, geez.
So I had to drill out the rivets, knock them through, put a new plate back in, rivet it again without shattering the rest of the comb, and then recut all the teeth on both sides. So, yeah, those are the sorts of things that are probably the most difficult things to make. And I say they can take 3 or 4 days easily to make, depending on the size of them.
Labor of love.
Yeah,
or frustration, absolutely. Depending on the mood you're in for that day.
There's been a few times that When the tooth broke in particular, I had to walk away and come back to it later, because otherwise I would have been so frustrated. Knocking out the pins and redoing it itself is a delicate job, not something to do when you're frustrated.
Yeah. Just understanding that that's something you need to wait until you're in a calmer headspace for is a good thing to know.
Yeah.
Are a lot of the things you make replicas or reproductions, or do you...
Pretty much everything is. There are so many things out there. I mean, just flicking through the back end of my booklet with the various things in, you've got the simple things such as needles, pins, little weaving tablets,
yeah,
things like that, spindle whorls, skates, spoons, all the way up to the complex things such as whalebone plaques, combs, and so on, that I tend to make items that are very closely based on the originals because there's such a rich collection of them there.
Yeah.
And also coming at it from a research point of view, I'm very, very wary of unfounded speculation, especially in this particular period, because with the rise of things like the Vikings TV series and, as I mentioned before, The Last Kingdom and various other ones, there are an awful lot of people who take the tack of, oh, well, they must have had this. It could have been made with the materials, therefore they had it. No. It doesn't work that way. Just because you like the look of this particular item and you want to make it out of bone doesn't mean that they did. So the best way to make sure that you're sticking to things which are accurate and that they are as true to what they would have been as possible is to base them on the real thing. So
absolutely.
Various pendants and such, I've made a range of them that are either in the style of the originals or direct replicas of the originals. And the same with combs and such. There are so many different combs that there's a lot of scope for your own designs. There's a lot of scope for making them in a certain way, so long as you understand how they were made.
Yeah.
So you can go, well, this pattern here, as I said before, there's a certain pattern that you find on the continent, but not in England. Well, so you wouldn't make an English-shaped comb with that pattern on it. Whereas you could pick a particular style of pattern or a way of doing the pattern in with a particular type of shape of the comb or size of the comb. And if the two of them are found in the same place in the same time frame, well, it's a logical thing that they may have had a comb that looked like this but was decorated in that way.
Yeah.
But you can't take a comb from the year 700 in France and decorate it with something that was found in Viking Age York 300 years later. So I tend to try and keep them as accurate as I can to the extent of basing a lot of them on the originals.
And that's cool, too, that you have such a rich... And also that you know the museums and archaeologists well enough that you've seen a lot of these replicas and be able to, or artifacts and been able to handle them and things like that. And you have a rich background of implements to take a look at and try and replicate.
Yeah, that's definitely an advantage of being in this country and doing it, is being able to, at the very worst, going to the museums and seeing the originals behind a piece of glass.
Yeah.
And potentially being actually able to go and handle them. I was doing a series of replicas from a particular museum, and I actually was allowed to go and handle the originals that I was making the replicas of, so I could get basically high-definition zoomed-in photographs that I could then print out at 3 or 4 times life size to actually see every single detail and nuance and how they went together and things to make as absolutely perfect a replica as I could. So that is a very, very definite plus point to doing it in this country.
Have you ever looked at, I don't know if you've ever looked at stuff in other parts of the world, bone working, things like that. Have you ever looked around to see the state of bone working elsewhere in the world? If you're mostly stuck to replicas and reproductions of things found in your part of the world?
Generally speaking, mostly this period and mostly this part of the world, just because that's what I'm interested in. But because of the circles that I move in and groups I'm a part of, I periodically will go down a wee rabbit hole of having noticed, oh, well, this is a prehistoric thing from China, or this was something that was found in 15th century Africa or something like that. because as well as being interested in the artifacts, which is the main thing that I'm interested in from the period, I'm interested enough in the actual bone working techniques and everything as well to have a look around and see how it's done in other places. I'm not anywhere near as interested or keep on top of the information as much as I do for basically early medieval Europe, but there's still an interest there.
Yeah. No, I was just kind of curious because, yeah, as a bone worker, I can't imagine that there's a whole lot of, like I mentioned to you before, I don't really see bone workers still existing as a craft the way I do blacksmiths or woodworkers or things like that. So I was kind of curious. I mean, I'm sure you run into people and you get exposure to other finds elsewhere in the world, and just kind of curious. Yeah.
Well, that's because most of the groups that I'm part of and mailing lists and such, they're archaeological bone working. So it's not actual bone workers. It's the archaeologists that are writing up the reports, and they're specialists in the bone artifacts. Now, some of them do as well, same as I initially started out. They go down the route of learning the techniques themselves as well in order to better explain what they're finding. But yeah, the general focus of these groups is the actual archaeological side of things, because as you say, there isn't that much in the way of actual bone workers still around. There's very few. I mean, you go to Amazon and you type in book on green woodworking or how to blacksmith or anything like that. I would say contemporary bone working books, I don't even think there would be a dozen. I've not checked for a little bit, but looking at what I've got on my shelf, I would say that there's probably half a dozen contemporary actual bone working books available in the last 20 odd years.
Do you want to shout out a couple of titles of ones that you think would be most helpful for someone that was trying to learn a little bit?
Okay, just give me a second to reach over.
Yeah.
There's an older one that was published possibly even in the 60s now, 1968, called Working in Plastic, Bone, Amber and Horn. I'm going to probably butcher the names because they're Scandinavian, but it's Erland Borglund and Jacob Flowensgard.
I will find a link for it and put a link up.
That might have been republished since, but that was actually a second-hand copy I picked up from withdrawn from a library sale book sale.
Yeah.
So it's not always that easy to get hold of. There's a much more recent one. This is actually, he's a New Zealand chap. And so he deals a lot with Maori culture and fish hooks and things like that.
Yeah.
This is probably the best new book that I've come across, possibly one of the only new books. And it's just called Bone Carving, A Skill Base of Techniques and Concepts.
Okay.
And that's by a chap called Stephen Meyer, M-Y-H-R-E. There's another one. This is possibly more up your alley. This is, again, an older book, maybe 70s or 80s. Again, picked up from a library sale because trying to get hold of a secondhand copy was murder. Yeah, 1981. And it's just simply called Discovering Horn by Paula Hardwick. Now, that's mostly about horn itself rather than the techniques. If I recall rightly, does have a little bit about the techniques because of how things got made.
Yeah.
But that's not as much on the actual making side of things, but it does have a wee bit about it. And then, oddly enough, there's actually one that's pitched almost at children, which is very interesting. And again, this is more covering the whole thing, but there's a little bit of techniques and stuff in it called... It's called Who's a Horn, What's an Antler? Crafts of Bone and Horn.
Oh, interesting. And you said that one's aimed more at children, huh?
Oh, pretty much, almost, yeah. It's got things in about projects for making little bits of jewellery and pendants and how to make earrings out of offcuts of horn and antler tips, and but also covers all the different animals that have them, all the way up to things like, you know, why giraffes' horns that they have on top of their head are not horns as such, and all that kind of thing. And then the majority of the other books that I pick up, and these are the ones that you're more likely to find, certainly in this country, is the one aspect of horn working that does still exist is stick dressing, on where it's the on the top of walking sticks and shepherd's crooks.
Oh, okay.
So they, there's a lot of books about that. Now, often they're in dealing with wood carving and such, but especially for shepherd's crooks, more so than walking sticks, having an actual sheep horn for the crook part of it, for the hook at the end,
yeah,
is still quite a big thing. And certainly over here, there's a lot of little local groups of old men doing stick dressing, and they'll take them to local country shows and things like that. Now, those books tend to be more prevalent because stick dressing itself is having a bit of a revival. And there's also your little books about heritage crafts and things that often deal with stick dressing where they don't deal with bone working and such. And I always pick those up as well because you never know what little bit of information you might find. So one of them I found, for example, was written by a guy who actually was a shepherd and used to do stick dressing while he was sat out on the hills.
Oh, that's cool.
Looking after his sheep. And so he had something to do in those long winter nights when he sat in his little shepherd's hut. He would stick dress. And one of the things he said was he would get an awkward horn sometimes that was bent out of shape and so on. And turns out what he'd actually do, as I was saying before about having direct heat and indirect heat, what he would do is if you boil horn for too long, it will break apart. So what he would do would get a turnip, boil the turnip until it was soft and very hot, then shove it on the end of the horn.
Oh, interesting.
Because the latent heat from the turnip and the slight bit of moisture would absorb into the horn enough that it was then flexible for him to bend it back into shape.
Oh, well, that is a technique I never would have thought of.
Yeah, I never would have thought of anything like that. But it solved all of his problems. He only needed to apply the heat to a very small area in order to straighten out the tip. He didn't want to apply direct heat. He couldn't just leave it in the water boiling. And so it ticks all the boxes for how he needs to do it to make it work. And I would have never thought of that, but it was just in this little book about an old chap sat up on the Yorkshire Hills stick dressing, and that's how he used to do it.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a cool technique to learn.
There's a couple of other books that I have as PDFs that I've not been able to get across, come across actually in print. I think there's a Dutch book about bone and antler working as well, which it's written in Dutch, but you can follow the pictures. But yeah, that's pretty much it. There's just not a lot out there.
Well, I mean, you gave me, what, 3 or 4 resources right there? So that gives people a good starting point if they want to learn a little more. Give them a couple of books to go try and reference, try and find. That'll be very helpful.
One that you might be interested in, it's a reprint of an old book. And it's mostly actually about the background and all kinds of industrial techniques as well. Yep. It's actually called Comb Making in America. And deals a lot with the horn combs and the tortoise shell combs and things like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's one of these modern reprints to order of a book published in 1925. So it's at the tail end of it still being a real industry.
Yeah.
It's not written in the same way as a history would be written now.
It's an industry, but probably starting to fade out at that point, I would imagine.
Yeah. But the people that were involved in it would still be alive. The factories were still around. It wasn't history in the same sense as it would be today.
Yeah. I said that would probably be valuable just for that. You know, you get actual people talking about what they did when they were industrially making these things and the process they went through and things like that. Yeah, I could find that one. I could see how that one would be very helpful. Thank you, Dave. I'm going to stop the recording now. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me, and I've kept this going a little longer than I anticipated. I didn't mean to take up so much of your evening, but I was having fun chatting, so hope you did as well.
As I said, I can talk for ages about this.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Folkcraft Revival Podcast. As always, the show notes and links from this episode can be found over at folkcraftrevival.com/... whatever the episode number is. Should tell you right now in your podcast player what episode this is. I appreciate you tuning in. If you have any guest or topic suggestions, or any other feedback for that matter, I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email over at daniel@folkcraftrevival.com. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Now let's get out there and make something.